There isn't much left to be said after Emily's wonderful talk last night and John Algio this morning. I feel as though at some level we've all been tuned in on very similar ideas, concepts, which is only natural because it's the theosophical worldview that is inspiring all of us. And so if, in part, what I have to share tonight sounds very familiar, it's not simply because I had those glorious 8 days at Emily's enjoying the lovely home and the beauty of the waterfront there and watching the swans be fed and the baby swans and so on, which are such a delight of being part of staying at Emily's, but it's even more because we do tune in on that same vision, which is really fundamental to the reason why we are being, why we are here. And so in some ways, too, what I would like to share this evening and the tenor of my comments really follow upon what I tried to suggest 2 evenings ago. I think it was Sunday. I'm a little bit fuzzy on what day is today, even, you know. It's just midst of convention and summer school, and any day is any day. But in any event, what I tried to point out then, that as we are human, at the human stage, we are, of course, that element which is radical in the production of change, that is, in altering our perception and thereby altering the world. I think this is particularly relevant to suggesting the comments tonight on living, as Emily has stressed, living in the eye of the storm. I'm not talking about the eye of the storm, but what we do there, as it were. And so I'd like, as so many do, I suppose, as is inevitable, to turn to the Bhagavad Gita. You'll recall that in the first chapter of the Gita, the narrator, Sanjaya, describes what must have been a truly incredible, ear-piercing, frightening roar. In the words of the Gita itself, conches and kettle drums, tabors and drums and cow horns suddenly blared forth, and the sound was tumultuous. The only thing that I can think of that is at all perhaps like that is an Indian wedding. Those of you who have been in India and heard, I see Anne nodding there. Anyone who has heard the incredible amount of sound that can be produced for what seems or should be a very solemn occasion, the ear-piercing sounds that continue on and on and on, I can see why this description would appear in the Gita. The narrator, of course, continues to describe the scene, you remember, with all its attendant noise. The tumultuous uproar rent the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra, filling the earth and sky with sound. Well, the description is so very vivid of this tumult caused by the 2 warring armies that have drawn up on the field of Kuru, the Kurukshetra, that one can almost hear the blare of the instruments presaging the battle and feel within the terror of this impending conflict. The situation is really not very far different in one sense from today. We may not be enduring full-scale conflict, let us hope we do not, in the sense that an exoteric reading of the Gita seems to portray. But there is, in the world today, we have to admit, a tumultuous blare of conches and trumpets and cow horns, certainly in a symbolic manner, if not actually. The storm clouds are certainly gathering swiftly, and we feel ourselves undoubtedly as fearful and as anxious as was our Juna, as trembling, as indecisive, as confused, as bewildered, as that representative of the human state before what appear to be demonic forces which have been let loose in the world, before indeed the many prophecies of doom to which Emily referred last evening, this anxiety which seems to build up. Matthew Arnold once described it very well, and we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Well, obviously it's not my intent to pursue an interpretation of the Gita tonight, but merely to use that setting of the first chapter as a symbol of our own time and condition. One further and rather significant fact, however, I think could be added. It gives us, I suggest, the key to what I do want to talk about tonight, and a key for meeting the circumstances in which we do find ourselves today. Now, it is recorded, therefore, that while Arjuna trembled with fear at the sound and the sight which assailed him, he still had enough presence of mind, if I may put it that way, to direct his charioteer, as we know, the divine Krishna, who is addressed at this point as O Achyuta, which is simply to the appellation, meaning he was addressing that changeless, immovable principle, which is, of course, the translation of that name, Achyuta, to bring him to the center of the field. In the midst, he said, between the two armies, stay my chariot. A remarkable event, it seems to me, a remarkable circumstance that he speaks, as it were, to that immovable principle to bring him to the center, to center him. Stay my chariot there in the center. And I suggest that this is the urgent need for each of us today, to move to the center and there stay our chariots. For only at the center can we begin to observe the entire field of existence. Only when the chariot in which we ride is stayed are we in a position to understand the mode of right action, to identify with one side or another in the conflict, to be whirled about by the winds of fortune, and to rush hither and thither without thought, pushed and pulled by the tempests of passion, by the factors, the ragings within ourselves, is to act blindly, without reason, without understanding. When the world, in other words, is in flames about us, and when all the conches of human misery are being sounded, surely we may say, well, we have to act. It is action that is called for, not a standing still, but a movement, any movement. There's no time, we are convinced, for quiet observation from the center. We must act. Well, let us pause a moment in that. I used the analogy in my previous discussion with you of the very beautiful little statue of Krishna. There is such a statue on the ledge above my desk at home, a constant reminder to me of this marvelous flute song which is forever played, as I spoke of it then. This particular beautiful little small bronze statue, of which I'm very fond, is also a reminder to me of my years of happy work at Adyar under our late President John Coates, as the statue itself was a gift from my colleagues there. So it's a double reminder of that center of the theosophical world where perhaps one comes to his roots in the theosophical tradition, and also that center of our own immortal being where the flute song can be heard. Well, perhaps it is time to consider then the value of moving to the center where the chariot of our personalities can be momentarily stayed, where the voice of the immovable may be heard, where we may find the secret of right action, the royal secret, as the Gita refers to it. That is to say, where we may hear the Krishna song. In these cyclonic times, when all the that seemed secure is being swept away, when there is all the fury of the storm sweeping about us, we may recall that at the eye of every storm is absolute silence, peace. Figuratively speaking, I suggest that is where the theosophist belongs. He understands, in other words, as did the Taoist sage, what the Tao Te Ching has so rightly called the benefit of existence and the use of non-existence. Numerous translations, of course, are available of that Tao Te Ching, most famous of all expositions, I think, of the utility of non-being. But let me quote a passage appearing in the recent quest book, The Guiding Light of Lao Tzu, by Henry Wei. You may know this in other translations. I think it's a very lovely one in this recent quest book. 30 spokes converge on the nave of a wheel. It is where there is non-being, hollow space, that the usefulness of the wheel lies. Clay is molded into a vessel. It is where there is non-being that the usefulness of the vessel lies. Doors and windows are hewn out to make a room. It is where there is non-being that the usefulness of the room lies. Therefore, while being is valuable, it is non-being that is useful. Now, does this mean, of course, that one is to cease being, to become nothing at all, a cipher in existence? Or does it point, as I suggest it does really, to a new mode of being, a mode in which action proceeds from a motionless center? Perhaps the highest form of action, right action or true action, is paradoxically not so much action as presence. Let me explain. Again, to quote the Tao, returning to the root means quiescence. Quiescence means renewal of life. And so it was, of course, that Lao Tzu spoke of the essential prerequisite of the meaningful life. Maintain quiescence with your whole being. It is that quiescence that is so perfectly represented in that statue of Krishna. It's so beautifully and succinctly expressed by the psalmist David in the utter simplicity of the words, "Be still." And the poet T.S. Eliot spoke of that quiescence as the still point of the turning world. The Irish poet mystic, who was indeed a member of the Theosophical Society, A.E., George W. Russell, wrote of that center within us through which all the threads of the universe are drawn. A center which is utterly still, yet serves as a mirror for all events. Well, it's easy enough, of course, to be rash in action, easy enough to rush headlong into activity with a frenzy born of passion to be up and doing. You know, it's sort of our Western way, let us now be up and doing sort of thing, that we have to somehow do anything. Do something, don't just stand there, you know, is the usual injunction to anyone who happens to be looking at a sunrise or sunset, you know. Well, do something. I'm not suggesting, of course, that we just sit in constant contemplation of emptiness. At times, we do have a sense of guilt if we pause while all about us, others are exhausting themselves in a multitude of tasks, you know, endlessly engaged in what they and sometimes we are prone to call, and what I grew up in Sunday school calling, good deeds, you know. So you had to do something good, like the Boy Scout, of course, who helped the reluctant little old lady to cross the street as his good deed for the day, only to discover when he got her across that she hadn't wanted to cross the street at all. Well, as theosophists particularly, we do occasionally feel these pricks of conscience when we are asked, as we so often are, but what do you do as a theosophist, you know? I like to just say, I don't do anything, I just am. And, you know, which confounds everybody. Mainly because I have long had a philosophy known as rhythmic laziness. I think it's the only way to live. One sort of, you know, flows, and if there's something to be done, well, all right, but do it in that rhythmically lazy manner. It's worked so far, you know. It carried me to Adyar and back, if you put it that way. Well, as I say, I'm not suggesting that we simply sit and contemplate emptiness, that we, as one of our members some years ago said, we sit on our nucleus, but, you know, of the universal brotherhood, but that we turn our backs on action or the performance of beneficial work, but that I would like to propose that the theosophical worldview may give a new meaning to action and may point to a mode of being in the world which underlies whatever action one performs, a way of service through presence. That is, one's very presence in the world acts in such a manner as to transform the world. Such a life, I think, is one lived at the center, at the eye of the storm. Contemporary psychology certainly recognizes that whole masses of peoples can be pulled into whirlpools of inner and outer disorder by a single powerful individual. And history, of course, is full of the records of such individuals whose very turbulence and excitement caught up the passions and frenzies of all about them. Genghis Khan, Rasputin, Hitler, the list, of course, is nearly endless. But psychology also recognizes the influence of the ordered individual, the one who, integrated and harmonious within, creates a center of calm without, whose very presence leads to a calming effect. History, too, provides examples of the great man whose greatness lay in the presence of his being in the world. From Krishna to Christ, there are the Buddhas, the awake ones, who call us to find that still center and there abide, and from that center to act meaningfully. These two contrasting modes are very well illustrated in an ancient story concerning two men who were plowing their fields. The earth was stony, the season had been bad, the rains had failed, and the river from which some meager irrigation waters usually had been brought was now dry. As they plowed their furrows, one man's face was tight-lipped and cold-eyed. He was thinking only of the hardness of his life, the aching of his feet and legs. He berated his half-starved horse that it would not go fast enough, and glancing at his fellow farmer, became convinced that his neighbor's wheat would grow fuller and taller than his. Meanwhile, his neighbor worked on with rhythm and grace, concentrating on how straight he could direct his plow, stopping now and then to rest his mare. He appeared tranquil, unhurried, without fatigue. As the sun continued to beat down on them both, and the heat of the day increased, the first plowman lashed out again and again at his horse, sweat pouring down his face and into his eyes, stinging him almost to blindness, and the veins of his hands standing out as he grasped the handle of his plow. He could think only that his neighbor was mocking him by purposely going about his work so slowly, and his rage built to a violent crescendo. Through his mind went the endless refrain, "If only I had his horse, I could plow twice as fast, twice as easily." In desperation, finally, he threw down his plow, scooped up the largest rock he could find, and with a wild cry, flung himself across the field toward his neighbor. The next day, the second farmer was again plowing his field, but now he was using two horses. He walked more slowly, however, for he was saddened as well as puzzled by the strange memory of the day before, when, startled by a sudden wild cry, he had looked up to see his fellow farmer running wildly toward him. Before he even had time to react, the man had fallen dead at his feet, his hand still clutching a massive rock. Until the day he himself died, he was never able to understand what had gone on in the other man's mind, or from where his savage and sudden violence had sprung. For both rage and peace are very private qualities, given birth in the fascinating secret places of the mind and heart. It is really not enough to say that the two men in this ancient tale had different states of mind and simply leave it at that. Clearly, the difference between them lay at some deeper level, working itself upward into consciousness from a center common to us all. Is it possible to so cultivate the values that emerge from such a center as to enable us to become not turned towards rage and violence, but to become what I have termed a presence in the world, a presence that radiates calm, that moves with grace and rhythm, that encourages creativity of spirit? Is it possible to disentangle our psychological natures from the entanglements that produce conflict and violence, permitting a free flow of energy from that interior center of our being, that center which is common to us all, and yet singular to none, yet always singular in its workings through one individual at a time? As we well know, all the ancient texts tell us that such disentanglement is possible. The process, of course, is well defined in both yogic and mystic scriptures, in all the religious traditions, in contemporary psychological systems that stress individuation, self-actualization, and transformation from a transpersonal level. In The Voice of the Silence, surely one of the most beautiful texts that we have been given, and which emphasizes the process of disentanglement, leading to that kind of enlightenment in which the individual becomes not merely self-enlightened, but a genuine light giver. The way has been called the Paramita Path, with seven portals through which the aspirant may pass on his journey to that center. These are often called the transcendental virtues, the paramitas, but they are really qualities of being, And because they're so frequently called transcendental, we always feel they are somehow beyond us, that we have not yet come into that position or condition in which we can begin their practice, that this is for the life of the Bodhisattva, which obviously we have not achieved as yet. But because they are modes of being in their essence, I suggest that we can begin to experience them. They are essentially present in that interior space which may be termed the eye of our own personal storms. And when we come to that interior space, when we come to that inner center, the outer storms begin to abate, not because we have acted upon them from without, but because we have acted upon them from that only true center where action becomes meaningful. It's as though the sun breaks through, dispersing even the darkest and most threatening of clouds. These golden keys that open the portals on the Paramita path are described by HPB, and so let me just read them and then perhaps look at them a little. Dana, the key of charity and love immortal. Sila, the key of harmony in word and act, the key that counterbalances the cause and the effect and leaves no further room for karmic action. Shanti, patience sweet that naught can ruffle. Viraga, indifference to pleasure and to pain, illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. Virya, the dauntless energy that fights its way to the supernal truth out of the mire of lies terrestrial. Dhyana, whose golden gate once open leads the Nalyar toward the realm of Sat Eternal and its ceaseless contemplation. Prajna, the key to which makes of a man a god, creating him a bodhisattva, son of the Dhyanis. It may be suggested that these form themselves quite naturally into four groups, three pairs with one standing alone, affecting those elements in our psychological nature by which entanglement in the storms of existence takes place. So let us examine these keys briefly to see how they may help us in the process of disentanglement, the process by which we move through the storm to that inner center, the eye of the storm, from whence creative peace may flow outwards, dispelling the storm. Modern man, it has been said in the ancient traditions of the East, is dominated by kama, desire, K-A-M-A. I'm not saying karma, but kama, desire, and passion is the way it is usually translated. Attachment to wealth, possessions, position. This is certainly self-evident. We all have our attachments. We all carry, certain things around with us that are indispensable, we feel, for our existence, for our identity, ideas to which we become attached, if not actual physical money and so on. The very nature of the storm that engulfs us is indeed permeated by kama, entangling us constantly in a web of self-concern, self-interest. But kama can be transmuted by dana, which is that true charity of spirit in which one employs all one is and has for the welfare of others. Charity usually is thought of, as we well know, as giving away that which we can very well do without and no longer need. It is that which is left over after we've, paid the bills and put a little bit in the savings account and made sure we have enough for ice cream tonight. Well, then we can give away whatever little bit remains. Dana, however, as true charity, is really that divine caring which is utterly without self. It is the concern constantly for the welfare of others, the spirit in which we recognize that everything we have, everything, is held in trust and must therefore be considered sacred, not as our own possession, but as the possession of the one life only, on loan to us, as it were. One of the Upanishads has put it so beautifully, not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear, but for the sake of the self is the husband dear. Not for the sake of the wife is the wife dear, but for the sake of the self is the wife dear. And so on, it continues. This spirit of Dana, genuine caring for that which is precious, that which is truly beautiful, and therefore infinitely precious in every form of life, in every other, is complemented, I suggest, by prajna, compassionate wisdom, the wisdom born of right knowledge, that right knowledge which perceives the preciousness in all, a wisdom that requires us, therefore, to act always in a spirit of universality, from an attitude centered in unity and radiating outwards to the circumference in a manner that is supremely impersonal. And so the fetter of kama is loosened by dana and prajna. Passion is transmuted into universal compassion, universal love, and the realization of the preciousness in all life. As a result of kama, it has been said, modern man is dominated by the second of the fetters that entangle him, krodha, often translated as hatred born of conflict, but perhaps more understandable as the antipathies, the jealousies, the animosities and bitternesses which arise between individuals. It is the universal melee that envenoms all human relationships, growing generally out of the confused and chaotic mind of the individual who fails to see how to act within the field of nature's inexorable laws with concord and cooperation, rather than in a spirit of discord and resistance. And so it may be said that krodha is transmuted by that paramita known as shila, complemented by dhyana. Shila is the principle that implies a process of constantly equalizing or equilibrating that which has been disturbed. It is the essence of harmony in speech, in action, in relationship. That the relationship is always harmonious because one takes into oneself whatever is said or whatever reaches one and transmutes it into a harmony that is immediately outgoing. I think in this regard very often of a story about Mr. Leadbeater that our late president John Coates used to delight in telling, and I think it is indeed a very beautiful story, not that John knew Mr. Leadbeater, but that he knew many, of course, as many of us have, who were very close to Mr. Leadbeater. And it is said that during a period when Mr. Leadbeater was under considerable attack and being very much abused and reviled and very, very dreadful things being said about him, that a friend wrote to him and said, I have such sympathy for you because this must be a very difficult time for you. It must be a very disturbing time for you. It must be a time when it's extremely difficult for you to get on with the work in which you are engaged. And the letter, and I believe this is a letter which is in the archives at Adyar, the letter from Mr. Leadbeater to this friend said, I suppose if I were to think about it, it is rather disturbing. But then you see, I never think about it. Which is the taking within of whatever is said and harmonizing it, sending it out in this beautiful manner of a compassionate understanding. Sheila is this process of the harmonization of speech, action, and relationship, a transcendental principle that achieves ultimate harmony by restoring equilibrium through time and change. Its action is on all planes of existence, visible and invisible, affecting both ourselves and others. So it is a virtue demanding careful attention and understanding. Its roots, of course, are in the great law of causality. And so the spirit of Sheila is complemented by dhyana, usually translated as contemplation, the principle activating the higher aspect of manas, and so opening the mind inwards toward the realm of truth eternal. The voice of the silence indeed compares dhyana to an alabaster vase, white and transparent. Within there burns a steady golden fire, the flame of prajna that radiates from Atma. So dhyana is also the principle employed by the seeker to awaken his spiritual perceptions, leading him to the light of genuine knowledge, that light by which he sees the all in all and knows himself one with all. And so it is the ceaseless awareness at every moment of that interior center. It is the constant contemplation, beautifully spoken of by the great Buddhist teacher Nagarjuna. What is there but to keep watch over one's mind both night and day? And so Krodha is transmuted by the application of universal laws to the daily life of usefulness and service. Finally, modern man is dominated, it is said, by moha, illusion born of ignorance, or rather the failure to differentiate between appearance and reality. And it is suggested then that this fetter may be severed by shanti, the essence of patience, fortitude, quietude, complemented by virya, dauntless energy. Shanti gives courage to the vacillating heart of the aspirant, and he who possesses this key will meet all temptations, all failures and disappointments, with a confidence born of a gentle and persistent will. Freed from fear and terror, the individual with the light of courage burning within his heart will ascend the mountain peaks of spiritual understanding. For shanti finds its complement in virya, the purposeful, one-pointed fixity of mind and heart that leads the individual in whom it is awakened to ultimate triumph. Failure neither daunts him nor causes him to despair, for he knows that, as the voice of the silence reminds us, each failure is success, and each sincere attempt wins its reward in time. For what is failure but simply our effort to achieve more than we can at this very moment? And so the individual is able to cross beyond the entanglements of moha to that realm of light where there is no ignorance, where there is a clear understanding of the value of appearance and the value of reality, and does not any longer confuse the two, but recognizes the usefulness of each, and therefore where anxiety for the future and regret for the past can no longer assail him. Finally, modern man, it is said, is dominated by lobha, covetousness and avarice, born of that insatiable greed for possessions, whether they be of physical things or of psychic or even spiritual qualities and capacities. Lobha represents that unappeasable hunger for acquisitions for the personal self. I must know more. I must possess more. I must somehow have this or that. That hunger which brooks no restraint, which seems constantly to devour others in its unremitting search for food to satisfy its desires. Such greed can be transmuted by the single virtue of viraga, the transcendental virtue which is the key to the middle portal called the gate of balance, the virtue that neutralizes all pairs of opposites by an attitude of sublime indifference to their play and to the entanglements caused by the samskaras. Perhaps a better word than indifference would be equanimity, or equal-mindedness to the opposites, although it is a stern and exacting quality in which both the mind and the heart are to be liberated from their attachments and self-seeking desires. Through viraga, then, that state of balanced equanimity, that perception which is, as the word itself indicates, without color, raga, without color, that state of balanced equanimity found only when one lives at the center rather than in the midst of the storms of desire and passion. Only then does one enter into the condition of true freedom. He is the one who is truly free in the world, for all places are his home. Every place is his because he owns no place. And so it is a freedom which is the unmistakable hallmark of the genuinely disentangled individual. To live at the center, to live at the eye of the storm where there is that utter calm, and by one's very presence to become a radiating point of light, surely this is the ideal, even though its full realization may lie in the future. And as again I remind you, I am not talking about a passive nothingness, but rather an action that moves that is not reaction, an action that moves from a center that is whole and complete. The voice of the silence so beautifully expresses that ideal and the possibility of moving toward it. Follow the wheel of life. Follow the wheel of duty to race and kin, to friend and foe. If sun thou canst not be, then be the humble planet. If thou art debarred from flaming like the noonday sun upon the snow-capped mount of purity eternal, then choose, O neophyte, a humbler course. Point out the way, however dimly and lost among the host, as does the evening star to those who tread their path in darkness. Give light and comfort to the toiling pilgrim, and seek out him who knows still less than thou. The siddhis of perfection may loom far, far away, but the first step is taken. The stream is entered. And so we may begin and make a beginning here, now, the only moment of time we shall ever have. The step can be taken. The stream can be entered. Not to make a beginning at all, because the cyclonic conditions of the world disorder seem too overwhelming for our small efforts to make a difference, may be to lend ourselves not only to failure, but to the ultimate betrayal of life itself.